the year Embraceable You, a trans woman, requested access to WIT. Nobody quite knew what to make of it. The question was new in cyberspace, and female echoids took to WIT to share their opinions. Some said, let her in. One agreed, on the condition that she avoid the conversations about PMS. Another questioned why the same condition wouldn't apply to a postmenopausal woman. Still others argued that WIT was a space for women who were brought up female, and that a trans woman, having benefited from the systemic advantages of the patriarchy for at least some of her life, wouldn't share that history. The conversation became a sprawling consideration of gender in cyberspace, the first of many to come. Somebody suggested starting another private conference for trans women. Shades of separate but equal, worried Stacy. Echo was a stronghold for New York lefties and artists. It had an LGBT conference, Lambda. It's jarring to read about how fiercely echoids debated the Embraceable You question, because it reveals just how much understanding of the trans experience has changed in the last two decades. But another factor at play that might be invisible to contemporary readers is an ongoing context of female impersonation. The text-based internet's social spaces were rife with gender crossing, and with the shortage of women online, men posed as women with regularity. Eliza Sherman discusses this phenomenon in a first-person account recorded for the Women's Internet History Project. Back then it was just so odd. So many men pretended to be women online. They would have these websites and you would think they were female, but they were actually men posing as women. I'm not going to go into the possible reasons for that, but it was really hard to find actual women with websites. The phenomenon stretches back to some of the earliest social spaces on the internet. Text-based fantasy games called multi-user dungeons or multi-user domains. On MUDs, gender play was encouraged. Most MUDs provided a long list of gender options for new characters. Pavel Curtis, the designer of one of the most well-known social MUDs, Lambda Mu, observed that its most sexually aggressive female-presenting characters were often played by men, interested in seeing how the other half lives and what it feels like to be perceived as female in a community. The media theorist, Eleuther Roseanne Stone, called this computer cross-dressing. In a 1991 paper, she cites another example, Julie, a beloved message board personality who turned out to be a middle-aged man. The false Julie had been mistaken for a woman the very first time he went online, and he was so fascinated by the way that women speak to one another in the perceived absence of men that he kept up the charade for several years, building an entire fictional persona for his feminine alter ego. This was a regular occurrence on BBSs, listservs, multi-user domains, and other chat platforms throughout the 1990s. On the nets, Stone writes, where grounding a persona in a physical body is meaningless, men routinely use female personae whenever they choose. This cut both ways, of course. In the relative obscurity of the textual internet, anyone could try on a new identity, which had its creative advantages and allowed a great many people the first-hand experience of previously invisible gender dynamics in a group setting. Women could choose male aliases in order to avoid undue attention or harassment, and trans people were able to express their gender identities safely and freely. However, one practical effect of all this computer cross-dressing was that the few women online had a much harder time finding one another. For many echoids, the subtext of the Embraceable You debate was, unbelievably, this, that if a trans woman joined WIT, she'd be followed by men pretending to be women. It wouldn't matter who Embraceable You was, or whether she deserved a safe space herself, because the floodgates would be open. I didn't know what to do, Stacy tells me. My fear was that if I let her in, all these men would start saying, I'm a woman, let me in, and how would I know who was a woman and who was not? Stacy wanted to allow for as many forms of communication on Echo as possible. Within WIT, that meant a place without male voyeurs. I felt like the George Wallace of cyberspace, she wrote. Unsure how to resolve the problem, Stacy told Embraceable You she could have access to WIT once she'd had her gender reassignment surgery. She retracted the mandate a few months later, and to this day regrets ever making it. But Embraceable You left Echo anyway. In the following years, several other trans women joined. The community grew more familiar with their identities. Echoids who had been clueless about the trans experience began to understand. Cyberspace makes it easier to hear people out, Stacy wrote. Trans echoids shared their stories, pushing back. Why should an expensive surgery be required to prove who you are? What authorizes the medical establishment to determine gender? Echo adapted its policies. Echoids were only able to reach a tentative understanding and agreement through a lot of words, volumes and volumes, over years of time, Stacy wrote. Perry Street. When I first make contact with Stacy, she's busy transferring Echo, which still exists, from one server to another. Moving a 30-year-old online community is like transporting a sourdough starter. Echo is a living culture in a jar. Susceptible to the harshness of the outside world, it must be fed and kept warm in order to provide a link between the old and new. The big transfer falls on the same weekend Stacy and I are supposed to meet in New York. Late the night before our coffee date, I get an email. The server move was a disaster, and she's been working all day and night to fix it. The crisis might spill into tomorrow. An hour later, she writes me again. All right, she begins. This move is going from bad to worse. We won't be able to meet after all. Apologetic, she sends me a few addresses. The original apartment in Greenwich Village, where Echo's servers first lived, and the art bar just around the corner, a frequent echoid haunt. I visit both places on a crisp fall morning. I'm not sure what I hope to see or feel when I lay eyes on them. Although bound by a physical backbone most of us hardly ever consider, the internet seems to float boundless from device to device. The sum of its experiences can't be revealed by any consideration of its infrastructure, and a cable tells us nothing about the conversations coursing through it. I stand on Perry Street, squinting as I hold the map on my phone up against the front door of the apartment building that once housed the city's first social network, and to be honest, I don't feel much. It's a nice building. Like many in this part of Manhattan, it looks expensive, with windows framed by decorative moldings of lions and mythological griffins. The street is lined with spindly, leafless trees and iron street lamps. Bustling around me are athletic men with dogs, tourists cut loose from the pack, women walking with frozen yogurt, all oblivious to the significance of this place. Shouldn't there be a plaque? We do that for buildings where poets and painters lived or died. Why not software and servers? I'm suddenly moved by the idea. Here lived Echo, where New Yorkers loved and laughed and complained and told one another just how much they hated themselves and why. When we finally do get a chance to talk, Stacy tells me a story about Perry Street. She has an expressive Long Island accent, cemented by 3 decades as a rent-controlled Manhattanite. When she speaks, you can hear the italics. Telling me about how her neighborhood has changed over the decades, she inflects at pointed intervals. There were laundromats, delis, all of that is gone, she says. I have to walk forever to get to the laundromat, which is a drag. In 1990, back when Greenwich Village was still a neighborhood, Echo was still a server in Stacy's apartment. Thanks to Al Gore's information superhighway, however, business was booming. And since Echo's modems relied on local telephone service, Stacy's incoming requests were jamming all the phone lines in the neighborhood. The phone company was forced to provide Stacy with a dedicated line. But in Manhattan, cables run underground. The city is too dense and tumultuous for overhead telephone lines. And so New York Telephone dug up Perry Street, all the way from the local central office to Stacy's doorstep. It was this weird thing, she tells me, to see the streets of New York being ripped up for something that I was doing. Not only was it a proud moment for me, it was like seeing the future happening and knowing that I was helping. Stacy's neighbors didn't share her pride. Their service was being interrupted, their street torn to pieces. Stacy knew they'd thank her later, when Perry Street had the fastest internet in New York City. F2F. According to a system-wide poll conducted around 1998, 83% of echoids said they met regularly face-to-face. Echo hosted monthly meetups at the Art Bar and a monthly softball game in Central Park. Stacy started a reading series for echoids called Read Only, She organized Public Talks, a film screening series, and the Virtual Culture Salon, a bi-monthly event co-presented by the Whitney Museum. By the mid-1990s, New York's Silicon Alley would be overrun with mixers, meetups, media events, and dot-com hype. But Stacy was the first person to link New York's technology pioneers together. Echo was, as an editor of the online newspaper At NY wrote in 1996, the bedrock of Silicon Alley. Stacy never really saw it that way. Echoards didn't network. They jammed, explored, went sailing. A group of Echoards got together monthly to divvy up a side of beef arranged for by a cohort upstate. Echo's house band, White Courtesy Telephone, played regularly at Lower East Side clubs. When Echoards had poetry readings or open mic appearances, they listed their gigs so others could show up. And after they got home, the first thing they'd do was log back on to Echo to swap stories. The strongest virtual communities are not strictly virtual, Stacy explains. If nothing else, real-world accountability made Echo civil. It's harder to be cruel to someone online when you might run into them on Monday night at the art bar. Echoids saw the whites of each other's eyes regularly enough to know one another as people, rather than usernames. Reconciliations were made over a beer, or a friendly game of softball. For better or for worse, Echo was a community, and it took care of its own. When that didn't work, Stacy stepped in. A moderator in every sense of the word. She went above and beyond to make sure people were getting along. If Echo was a small town, then Stacy was the mayor, sheriff, and the tourism bureau at once. She made the rules and enforced them. If somebody was being awful, she had the authority to give them the boot. Stacy was more of an autocrat than these huge corporations can be, Howard Middlemark, a novelist who has been active on Echo since 1989, tells me. She could finally say, "You, you're fucking out of here." Banishment was reserved for only the worst offenders. There's an entire chapter in Stacy's book devoted to what Echoards called the fear, that feeling of horror a truly objectionable person sows with their behavior online. Echo had a Nazi once, and its share of sexual harassers. Marisa Bo remembers an episode in which a young guy, who thought he was, like, really subversive, posted about incest in every Echo conference. Stacy forbade ad hominem attacks, and since the incest posts weren't directed at anyone in particular, they didn't violate Echo rules. Marisa found them as upsetting as vandalism. When the world that you're in is made purely of speech, posting offensive material just for the sake of it is like you're bombing the buildings. All of this should be familiar today. The internet still got its share of Nazis, trolls and stalkers, and a social network that folds seamlessly into everyday life feels like a natural idea. That's what all our social networks do now. We invite our friends to parties on Facebook, and we show them what they're missing through photo and video stories. We follow one another's travel schedules, love lives, and pets on social media, moving with ease from real life to online life, blurring the boundaries between the two, and often mistaking one for the other. But Stacy understood early on just how important people are to the network. As Echo's final authority, she nurtured discussion and enlisted Echoids to lead conversations in their fields of interest. These hosts had carte blanche to engineer the particular cultural atmospheres of their conferences. "Echo is Echo because of the hosts," she wrote in 1998. "The relationships we have are formed by what we tell. Hosts get us to tell each other everything." In order for Echo to thrive, Horn realized that it needed a core base of vocal, participatory users. Howard Rheingold, in The Virtual Community, Homesteading on the Electronic Frontier, a book about virtual communities that completely omits Echo, incidentally, documents this strategy at work across the network, from a BBS in France with paid animateurs, culled from its most active users, to the well hosts in his own backyard. "Hosts are the people," he wrote, "who welcome newcomers, introduce people to one another, clean up after the guests, provoke discussion, and break up fights if necessary." We're all hosts now. The comment fields below our Instagram and Facebook posts are our own personal conferences. but the more formal convention continues as well. Reddit, the so-called front page of the internet, is a glorified bulletin board system, and each subreddit, which Echoids would call a conference, has its moderators, who make editorial decisions and lead conversation. Communities like Facebook and Twitter have moderators too, although the role is no longer practiced by deputized users. Instead, paid employees, working in obscurity, often abroad, manually remove offensive content and respond to claims of abuse and harassment. That these after-party cleanup duties would become more important than the party itself is an inevitability of scale. It's what happens when you invite everyone on Earth. As a rule, every conference on Echo had a male host and a female host. The pair, in exchange for free access to the service, would keep things civil and interesting. That half of Echo's hosts were women was, again, a conscious effort. Stacy called it cyber-affirmative action. It was essential to her that when women dialed into Echo, they'd see other women in the thick of it. Knowing they were not in the minority, and that their administrators were not all men, encouraged women to post instead of lurk, and in that way, they became part of Echo's culture. The men had to hear them. I heard women talking about things I wouldn't normally hear women talking about, says Howard Middlemark. Talking about men in ways they wouldn't usually share with me. At its peak, Echo had around 46,000 users. More than half were lurkers. Even today, most people are lurkers. On social media platforms everywhere, a vast, silent majority listens, reads, and keeps to itself. It's the social dark matter of the internet, the force holding us all together. Those who did post actively on Echo, about a tenth of Stacy's subscribers, were the diehards. They were the hosts, the contrarians, the pot stirrers, the core group. Although Echo still exists, tumultuously but successfully moved over to a Linux server not long ago, only a fraction of that core group remains. Like any family, the remaining Echoids have gone through a lot together. There has been at least one Echoid death. Echoids were among the earliest to discover how difficult it is to mourn someone when their words remain, like ghosts, in the machine. 2 decades of conversation represents a staggering amount of emotional equity. Time spent arguing, riffing, making nice, making opinions, and flirting. Echo has had its share of romances, and many Echoids went all the way to cybersex in the service's private corners. And then, of course, there is the internecine drama of affairs gone south. But Echoids share a larger cultural history, too. During O.J. Simpson's infamous 1994 Bronco chase, while most of America watched the helicopter footage on the news, Echoids were posting their immediate reactions in real time. Stacy shares part of this thread in her book, Cyberville, and it reads exactly like a group of people live-tweeting a major cultural event a decade before the invention of Twitter. Echoids called it simulcasting, and it came naturally to the medium. They did it during the Oscars, during Anita Hill's testimony at Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearings, during the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. On September 11th, 2001, Stacy ran to her keyboard at precisely 8:47 a.m. and typed, "A plane just crashed into the World Trade Center." On Echo, discussions ranged high and low. People shared the contents of their fridges, their purses, and their pockets. "The hottest topic for a while was a discussion about shampoo," Stacy wrote. "Shampoo! Who would want to talk about shampoo?" And yet the conversation is oddly revealing. Details like these humanize the words on the screen. Here were New Yorkers, living their lives, eating and complaining and washing their hair, while the world carried on around them, as it does around us all. Stacy recently donated all of Echo's archives, its 20 years of unbroken conversation, to the New York Historical Society. "Someone in the 22nd century and beyond is going to look back and have this treasure trove of history," she tells me, genuinely proud. Echo's legacy might not be what it predicted about the future of social media, although it did predict basically everything, but what it will reveal about its past. It provides an account of how real New Yorkers lived, unvarnished by the passage of time. There's a reason Stacy's book about Echo is called Cyberville. Echo was an elective community, reached through keyboard and modem. It had its hotshots and hierarchies, its cops and its creeps. Not everybody got along, but most stayed for the camaraderie. They were citizens of a city within a city, where you were only as good or as alive as your words. Stacy Horn originally sold Echo to New Yorkers as a local stop on the information superhighway. But the highway was built through town. Echo became like one of those rest stops on the scenic route, full of characters and self-published histories. People wander in every once in a while, but mostly it's off the map. Somewhere in the collapsed space between the internet's past, a wild west of homesteads, and today's app-centric internet, which is many things, but certainly not a conversation where anyone writes for free or freely. Echoids get on the highway sometimes to visit big cities like Facebook and Twitter. For all the action in these glitzy new metropolises, it all feels eerily familiar. To join Echo today, you fill out a form on the Echo website and wait for Stacy to send you a new user packet in the mail. Mine took a week. It contains a welcome letter, return addressed Echo Communications Group, which begins with an exhortation. Thank you and congratulations! You're about to join an eclectic, opinionated, slightly dysfunctional community called Echo. Before moving on to the caveat, we use this totally retro software that we haven't upgraded in forever, and getting around on Echo is not like getting around on the web. But hang in there, it's worth it. The enclosed instructions might be millennial-proof. Echo is still a BBS, which means it's not on the web. Rather, it's accessed via Telnet, a protocol that allows me to dial Stacy's server directly. This requires opening Terminal, a command line application that serves as a kind of text-based window into the operating system, and summoning Echo with a typed command. ssh.claire@echonyc.com. The Echo welcome packet also includes a cheat sheet of Unix commands, and mastering those takes an afternoon. I am ostensibly savvy about these things, but using Echo feels like how hacking looks in movies. Eventually I get the hang of it, typing JMOV to join the Movies and TV Conference and SH222 to read the 222nd item posted there. I read Echo's ongoing Star Trek discussion, which spans a decade. When I type O, as in who is online, I discover the handful of people here with me in Stacy's server, where there are no advertisements and no clickbait. Using Echo feels like slicing a knife through the desktop metaphors, through the illusions, through the cloud. It's a pure channel, the skeletal core of social media. For those of us raised on the semantics of the World Wide Web, systems like Echo are deeply unintuitive, because the web is our only frame of reference for how the world's digital information is traveled. Even after all I've learned about Echo's world of text, while I'm connected to it, my fingers keep drifting to the trackpad. So hardwired am I to point-and-click interfaces. Echo is not on the web. Stacy couldn't afford to make the leap back in 1993. And its totally retro software feels shockingly unfamiliar. With no links, nothing to click, and no URLs, it's missing something fundamental to the modern experience of communications media, something so intimately familiar that many people don't even notice it's there. If we're all fish in the online sea, Echo is missing the water. It's got no hypertext. Chapter 10. Hypertext. When we say the words internet and web, we often mean the same thing. The force, larger than nature, that emanates from our screens. But internet and web are not interchangeable. As we've learned from Echo, people were connecting online for decades before graphical web pages appeared on the scene. They dialed directly into each other's machines and into host computers to exchange files and post messages, as on Echo or The Well. Or they participated in commercial online services like AOL, CompuServe, and Prodigy. Before the web, when people talked about the net, or going online, this is usually what they meant. Many of these ad hoc networks interacted with, and eventually coalesced with, the infrastructure of the internet, which finally hit critical mass when the ARPANET's successor, the National Science Foundation's NSFNet, gave way to the network we use today, with the appearance of commercial internet service providers in 1994. It was a great complication. Early maps of ARPANET were easy to read, a few nodes placed in America's academic and military capitals, radiating in straight lines of wire and fiber. As the amount of nodes increased, the maps grew busier and the straight lines multiplied, softening into wide curves to accommodate their multitudes. Finally, the geographical background disappeared from internet maps, and the network itself went sovereign. Today, a map of the internet is a tensile, crazy, fractal thing. It resembles a beating heart, a web of synapses, a supernova. On top of all of this sits the World Wide Web, a network of interconnected visual pages built in a shared language called HTML, or Hypertext Markup Language. Hypertext is not a word we use frequently today, but much of the web is built from these hypertext documents. Structured pages of text, images, and video dotted with clickable links connecting individual points to one another. Those connections don't just influence how we navigate the web. Google built its empire on a search engine that brought up web pages with the highest number and quality of hypertext links. But how we communicate with one another, and ultimately how we understand the world. In a way, it's fundamental. The Talmud is a hypertext, with layers of annotations arranged in concentric rectangles around the theological heart. Any text referencing another is considered a form of hypertext. Sequels, which begin where the last page of the previous book left off, footnotes, endnotes, marginalia, and parenthetical asides. Sprawling self-referential novels like Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake are like flattened hypertexts. And scholars love to cite The Garden of Forking Paths, a short story by the Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges, as the height of pre-computer hypertext. This web of time, Borges wrote, the strands of which approach one another, bifurcate, intersect or ignore each other through the centuries, embraces every possibility. He may have loved the World Wide Web. The web as we know it isn't modeled on Borges, Joyce, or the Talmud. The most famous hypertext pioneers are men. Doug Engelbart, Jake Feinler's mentor at Stanford, incorporated hypertext into his online system. And Ted Nelson, a Bay Area counterculture hero, coined the word and has championed utopian hypertext ideas for decades. But the web appeared on the scene only after hypertext principles and conventions have been explored for nearly a decade by brilliant female researchers and computer scientists. They were the architects of the hypertext systems that time forgot. Systems with names like Intermedia, Microcosm, Aquanet, Note Cards, and Wiki. The earliest ontological frameworks of the information age. Hypertext is, in many ways, the practice of transforming pure data into knowledge. And like programming a generation before, it was where the women were. Microcosm. To understand hypertext, I've turned to one of the brightest computer scientists in the world. Dame Wendy Hall is a garrulous, strawberry blonde Brit with a disarmingly warm manner and a busy calendar. We're talking over Skype, 9 hours apart. Wendy, who was appointed Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire, the female equivalent of being knighted, in 2009 for her contributions to computer science, is in a hotel room in London, dressed for dinner. I'm in my pajamas, drinking coffee, surrounded by index cards, in my office in Los Angeles. For reasons I don't yet understand, she has chosen this moment to catch me up on medieval European history. The Battle of Hastings, to be precise. It's something we learned about in history, Wendy tells me, unsure if news of William the Conqueror's 11th century triumph ever made it stateside. William the Conqueror earned his nickname by invading England from its southern coast and defeating the last Anglo-Saxon king, Wendy explains, as I indulge this diversion. A few years later, he decided to take stock of his spoils, the entire Saxon kingdom. He ordered an audit of everything he owned. Every cow, every sheep, every person, every house, every village, everything, she says. They went round, by hand, counting everything up. The result was an unusual book, now invaluable to historians, detailing the minutiae of the Saxon world, the only survey of its kind. Because the judgments made by the Norman assessors who compiled it were supposed to be definitive, native English people called it the Domesday Book, spelled D-O-M-E-S-D-A-Y in Middle English. As the British cleric Richard Fitzneil wrote nearly a century later, decisions made in the Domesday Book, like those of the Last Judgment, are unalterable. The Domesday Book is what led Wendy Hall, in a circuitous way, to her career creating hypertext systems long before the dawn of the web. In 1986, as Wendy was beginning her teaching career, the BBC, that's the British Broadcasting Corporation, she reminds me gently, celebrated the 900th anniversary of the Domesday Book by updating it for the modern world, issuing a new British census on a pair of multimedia video laser discs, then the height of technological sophistication. They called them, of course, the Domesday Discs. More than 1 million people contributed to the project, which became a massive volunteer time capsule encoded in bits and light. Every school in the country was asked to send in 3 photos of their area, Wendy explains. School children wrote accounts of their day-to-day life. Britons sent in photos of office parks, pubs, and windmills. One child, from the village of Spennymoor, contributed this spot-on prediction of the future. Robot limbs will be used when natural limbs are lost. Computers will take over much of the diagnosis now made by doctors. Food will be made tastier by artificial means. Children will learn chiefly by computers. This crowdsourced survey made up the first of the 2 Domesday Discs. The second was filled with interactive material about British heritage, government, and royalty, including census data and some early virtual reality-like tours of notable sites. When Wendy saw the discs for the first time, they blew her away. It wasn't the information that impressed her as much as the way it was displayed. The ideas were stunning, she tells me. The Domesday discs were interactive, using interconnected links that could be navigated with a cursor, much as we're accustomed to doing on the web today. For Wendy, moving with ease from first-person reflections on British life to census data and 3D photo tours was a rich, rewarding, and immersive experience. She'd never seen a computer do anything like it before. Of course, she'd never been much interested in computers. Although her alma mater, the University of Southampton, was one of the first schools in the United Kingdom to teach computer science, Wendy was a student of pure mathematics. According to her doctoral advisor, Wendy was, in those years, a shy and retiring student, working in an area of topology so obscure that to this day I can't understand the title of the thesis. She learned some programming in a first-year course, but found it tedious and impersonal. I was happy in my world of mathematics, and really didn't see then that computers would ever really offer me anything, she told a radio interviewer in 2013. But once she saw the Domesday Discs, she overlooked her distaste. Suddenly, she understood what kinds of experiences computers could make possible, and as personal computers began to appear in the United Kingdom, I began to see the future, she says. Not everyone saw it as clearly. When Wendy returned to the University of Southampton after a stint teaching mathematics to trainee teachers, she accepted a lecturing position in computer science. But her enthusiasm for multimedia was out of step with the established views of the department. One professor told me in public once that if I carried on doing this multimedia work, there was no future for me at Southampton or in computer science, she remembers, because I wasn't writing compilers or new programming languages or doing operating systems. Many of her colleagues didn't consider interactive multimedia to be real computer science. It was seen as something fluffy, less serious, far closer to the humanities than to classical programming. But Wendy couldn't shake the glimpse of the future she had seen, a future where images, texts, and ideas were connected through intuitive screen-based links, and computer screens were approachable to all. In 1989, she left Southampton and took a job at the University of Michigan, where she immersed herself in American tech culture, went to conferences, and finally learned that clickable multimedia on computers was indeed a serious discipline and that it had a name. The Americans called it hypertext or hypermedia. Although her interests seemed out there to most of her British colleagues, she was right at the cutting edge in the United States. She returned to Southampton with a blinding vision for a new hypertext system. In order to explain it, she takes me back in time, again. This jump is only across decades rather than centuries. Wendy tells me about the Earl of Mountbatten, a second cousin of Elizabeth II. Mountbatten is something of an avatar for 20th century Britain. As last Viceroy of India, he oversaw the country's transition into a modern republic. He captained a naval destroyer during the Second World War and was appointed by Churchill to Supreme Allied Commander of the Southeast Asian Theater, where he oversaw a bloody Burmese campaign under monsoon rains. He met Stalin. He met Emperor Hirohito. However, his prominence in British colonial history made him a target. In the summer of 1979, long after his retirement, as Mountbatten was lobster potting from a wooden boat off the coast of County Sligo, he was assassinated, along with his family, by the Irish Republican Army. They bombed the boat to pieces, blowing his legs almost clear off. The Mountbattens lived in Romsey, a market village so old the medieval doomsday book made note of its three water mills. According to the schoolchildren who surveyed the village for the Doomsday Disc Project, among the most salient features of life in Romsey in 1986 were a preponderance of punks. Their spare time, of which they have a lot, is spent hanging around with friends, sometimes playing Space Invader machines, with money from Dole. A beloved fish shop, a Waitrose supermarket, and Broadlands, the Palladian estate where the Earl of Mountbatten entertained royal visitors. Broadlands sits on the River Test, which only 10 miles south flows past Southampton to join the briny waters of the English Channel. As it happens, the University of Southampton is known for its archives, which is why, after his violent assassination, the remains of the Earl of Mountbatten's considerable life ended up in its library. At Southampton, the Mountbatten archive joined millions of manuscripts, but it was distinctly modern in comparison to most of the library's holdings. Because Mountbatten's public life transected all the touchstones of 20th century media, the library inherited some 50,000 photographs, speeches recorded on 78 RPM records, and a large collection of film and video. There was no linear sequence to the material, save chronological order, and no hope of fitting it neatly into a database. 10 years later, Wendy Hall returned from her hypertext sabbatical in America. Not long after she'd settled back in, she heard a knock at her office door. Word of her interests had drifted from the computer science department to the library. "The archivist came to see me," Wendy remembers, "and he said, 'Couldn't we do something wonderful? I've got this multimedia archive. It's got pictures, it's got film, and it's got sound. Couldn't we put it on a computer and link it all together?' And that was the beginning. The Mountbatten archive was the perfect test case for a hypertext project. A vast, interrelated collection of documents spanning many different media, subject to as many readings as there could be perspectives on the last century of British history. Wendy put together a team, and by Christmas 1989, they had a running demo for a system called Microcosm. It was a remarkable design. Just as the World Wide Web would a few years later, Microcosm demonstrated a new, intuitive way of navigating the massive amounts of multimedia information computer memory made accessible. Using multimedia navigation and intelligent links, it made information dynamic, alive, and adapted to the user. In fact, it wasn't like the web at all. It was better. Microcosm's core innovation was the way it treated links. Where the web focuses on connecting documents across a network, Wendy was more interested in the nature of those connections, how discrete ideas linked together and why, what we would today call metadata. Rather than embedding links in documents, as the web embeds links in its pages, Microcosm kept links separated, in a database meant to be regularly updated and maintained. This link base communicated with documents without leaving a mark on any underlying document, making a link in Microcosm a kind of flexible information overlay, rather than a structural change to the material. To use one of Wendy's examples, say I'm browsing the Mountbatten archive using her system, Microcosm, circa 1989. I'm interested in Mountbatten's career in India, a 2-year period during which he oversaw the country's transition from colonial rule to independent statehood. This history has its recurring characters. His field marshal, the leader of the Indian National Congress, Jawaharlal Nehru, and of course, Mahatma Gandhi, whose name is everywhere in the source material. Say also that within the Microcosm link base, an instance of the name Mahatma Gandhi has been linked to some multimedia information, a video, perhaps, of a Gandhi speech. Because of the nature of Microcosm links, that connection isn't isolated to a single, underlined, hyperlinked blue instance of those words. Rather, it's connected to the idea of Gandhi, following the man, wherever his name may turn up, across every document in the system. Further, if I were to bring a new document into Microcosm, the system would automatically identify any words corresponding to links in the link base and update it accordingly. Imagine the analog on the web we know today. For every name, for every idea, for every linkable thing, a single repository of supplementary material, updated by everyone in the world, filtered based on parameters determined by the user. Links in Microcosm could be tailored to the user's knowledge level and could point to several places in the link base at once. Microcosm was even able to dig up new links on the fly by running simple text searches on all the material in the system, a prescient design that anticipated the importance of search in navigating information. This generic linking, in concert with link bases, created a system that could adapt to its users while presenting them with more opportunities to learn. Links in themselves are a valuable store of knowledge, Wendy explained. If this knowledge is bound too tightly to the documents, then it cannot be applied to new data. Which is to say, where one instance of a connection might be interesting, multiple instances, expressed laterally, look more like truth. By making space for this generic knowledge, Wendy's system placed value on the association between documents, rather than on the documents themselves. To hypertext's small but active community of scholars, this is what the field was all about. In the years between 1984 and 1991, a flurry of hypertext systems like Microcosm emerged from universities and from research labs at technology companies like Apple, IBM, Xerox, Symbolics, and Sun Microsystems. Each suggested different linking conventions, spatial associations, and levels of micro and meta precision over contained corpora of information. If this sounds dry, remember that managing, navigating, and optimizing information is a central pursuit of modern life. We do it 50 times a day before breakfast. And that each one of these systems had the potential to become as important to us as the web is today. The young discipline of hypertext was heavily populated with women. Nearly every major team building hypertext systems had women in senior positions, if not at the helm. At Brown University, several women, including Nicole Yankelovich and Karen Catlin, worked on the development of Intermedia, a visionary hypertext system that connected five distinct applications into one scholar's workstation and invented in the process the Anchor Link. Intermedia inspired Apple, which had partially funded the project, to integrate hypermedia concepts into its operating systems. Amy Pearl, from Sun Microsystems, developed Sun's Link service, an open hypertext system. Janet Walker at Symbolics single-handedly created the Symbolics Document Examiner, the first system to incorporate bookmarks, an idea that eventually made its way into modern web browsers. For women interested in the nature and future of computers, hypertext was far more collegial than other areas of computer science, which was at that time seeing a rapid decline in female participation at both the academic and professional level. The reasons for this aren't cut and dried, but they reflect some of the same tendencies at play over previous generations. While the whole foundation of hypertext is collaborative, suggests Intermedia's Nicole Yankelevich, and collaborative work appeals to women, hypertext was also, like programming before it, an entirely new field, a clean slate upon which women could mark their place. Further, hypertext was open to scholars from outside computer science departments, who emerged from such wide-ranging disciplines as interface design and sociology. What these people shared was a humanistic, user-driven approach. To them, the final product wasn't always software. It was the effect software had on people. But I don't really get that until I start talking to Kathy Marshall. Note cards. Kathy is a hypertext researcher who spent most of her professional career at Xerox PARC, a Palo Alto think tank founded by the printer company in 1970 to help invent the paperless office of the future. "I have to ask you a little about your process," she says in our first interview. Interviewing hypertext researchers entails its share of going under the microscope. Many of them have never shaken their professional interest in how people organize their thoughts. The second time Kathy and I talk, I find myself describing to her my office pinboard of index cards and serial killer-like yarn threads. She shares her own approach. "If I write something, and if it doesn't work, I'll throw out the whole thing and start again," she tells me. "I don't think you lose what you've written. It's still in your head. Over time, what you're doing is changing what's in your mind. What's on paper is just incidental." She makes this comment offhand, but the insight knocks me out. That's what software is, I realize. A system for changing your mind. Kathy grew up in Los Angeles and was one of the first women to attend Caltech after it went co-ed in 1970. She was only 16, small, under 5 feet on a good day, and mildly averse to math and science. The summer she matriculated, she was more interested in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, J.D. Salinger, and macrame than differential equations. When she asked for help, she remembers one professor who told her she'd be better off as a housewife. "My housewifing skills are even worse than my math skills," she thought at the time. And another, who waited until the day she missed class to tell a dirty joke. A fellow student filled her in on the punchline, which she still remembers, something about a whorehouse keeping down the fucking overhead. It wasn't the joke that bothered her. It's that the professor waited to tell it. "I felt so conspicuous and weird," she says. When she graduated from Caltech with an English degree, she started working as a systems analyst for a company that did radars and signal processing in Santa Monica. Her office had a view of the ocean, but she wrote utility code for a prime microcomputer, about as dry a technical job as you could get in those days. She went to work at Xerox PARC in the mid-1980s. Even outside computing circles, PARC was known for its freewheeling, hothouse approach. Engineers worked alongside anthropologists on a terraced campus built into a wooded hillside overlooking Silicon Valley, and important meetings were held in a room full of corduroy beanbag chairs, low and cozy enough that nobody would be tempted to jump up and attack anyone else's ideas. After so many years of feeling like an outsider, Kathy worked hard to become part of Xerox PARC's unorthodox workplace culture. "The thing I loved most about PARC is that it was really multidisciplinary," she remembers. I think it would be hard to find a place that was like that now. They weren't afraid to hire people that had different kinds of backgrounds. The mix was fun. She'd sometimes get silly with the computer scientists, putting ivory soap in the office microwave until it made huge piles of snaking froth. And she participated in Park's Artist-in-Residence program, which paired artists with technologists to create ambitious new media works. Her partner, Judy Malloy, a poet, would often cut a sideways path across the Park campus, through a field with horses and under a barbed wire fence, just to pass by Kathy's office window and wave hello. Note cards, the first system Kathy worked on at Xerox PARC, was modeled after the kinds of old-school writing techniques about which we'd soon find ourselves debating the relative merits. The software emulated the way you wrote papers when you were in junior high, with note cards and file boxes. Using hypertext links, users could chain their cards into complex collections, sequences, and mental maps, modeling their thought processes and making it easier for others to understand their conclusions. Note cards wasn't a writing tool, and it wasn't an information browser like Microcosm either. When pressed, Kathy calls it an idea processor. Hypertext is to text, as the technical grammar of cinema is to celluloid. Words on screen become a dynamic medium through buttons and links, just as jump cuts and editing tricks turn moving images into movies. This grammar can be applied to any kind of text, making hypertext highly useful for everything from browsing the web, as we do today, to idea processing and writing choose-your-own-adventure fiction. Note cards was designed for intelligence analysis. Before recommending policy, Kathy figured, intelligence brass might want to examine the underlying argument. "Back then I was naive," she says, and laughs. The intelligence community never picked up on hypertext, but note cards fit perfectly into the multidisciplinary atmosphere of Xerox PARC, a place where anthropologists, linguists, physicists, and computer scientists worked alongside one another. Installed on all the campus workstations, note cards became a vital tool for sharing ideas across disciplines, and its influence flowed beyond PARC's borders. In 1987, Apple released a note cards-like application, HyperCard, which came bundled with Apple Macintosh and Apple IIgs computers and became the most popular hypermedia system ever developed before the advent of the World Wide Web. People used it to build databases, write branching novels, and create PowerPoint-like presentation slides. Popular games, like the best-selling CD-ROM Myst, were prototyped in HyperCard. Within Apple, it was often used to test out interface design ideas, and some publishers even issued magazines as HyperCard stacks. 1987 was a banner year for hypertext, as it happens. Beyond the release of HyperCard, it marked the first academic hypertext conference, Hypertext 87, in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Academic conferences of this type can forge intellectual communities out of atomized researchers, and this is what happened in North Carolina. Twice as many delegates as expected showed up, leading one attendee to observe a rueful sense that this was the last time any hypertext gathering will be of manageable size. It was a heady mix, unusual for a technical conference, due largely to hypertext's many possibilities in the humanities. Computer scientists rubbed elbows with classicists, professors with entrepreneurs. "The hypertext conferences were lovely, wonderful in those days," Wendy Hall tells me. "We had what I call the literati there, the poets and the writers. I think that's why it attracted more women." "Computer science has always marginalized people that are interested in users," explains Kathy. "But they found common ground in hypertext research, which was really the study of how people use computers to organize thoughts and data." Those who attended Hypertext 87 came home emboldened by the realization that hypertext wasn't an esoteric interest pursued by only a few fanatics, but rather a true movement, one to which tech giants like Apple had clearly been paying attention. "There were little islands of ideas when we started," Kathy remembers. "But as the community coalesced, scholars like Kathy and Wendy began to think of their vastly different systems as part of a whole, The hypertech systems to come would influence one another in manifold ways, progressively refining the ideas that undergird our century's most transformative information technology. Part of being interested in users is paying attention to how they use software once it's in their hands. Surveying a group of Xerox PARC scholars working in note cards, Kathy's colleagues found that although each person inhabited the system differently, most used it to plot the big picture, organizing and structuring, sketching outlines, and maintaining references. Building connections and viewing them globally helped writers work through their arguments and ideas. And since note cards allowed multiple arrangements to exist in parallel, writers could explore various interpretations before settling. Kathy called this kind of work knowledge structuring, and it would dominate her subsequent research. The children of note cards, Aquanet, a system named after a hairspray because it held knowledge in place, and Vicky, the first spatial hypertext system, allowed users to organize ideas spatially from the outset, creating graphical schemas for how things fit together. Studying philosophy and logic, and consulting with the anthropologists and social scientists at Xerox PARC, Kathy learned how interpreting material and developing a position is often a process of abstract associations, difficult to articulate within the bounds of language, no matter how informal. Her hypertext systems were meant to empower kinesthetic thinking, the process of moving things around and trying them out, akin to wiggling molecular models in space or moving a jigsaw puzzle piece into different orientations. All of this might sound bogglingly abstract and strange. Why spend so much time arranging boxes on a screen? But even in the physical world, the piles and clusters we make reflect our thinking. I'm reminded of Jake Feindler's desk at the NIC, covered in precious piles of paper, and of my own desk at home, with its mountains of dog-eared books, notepads, printouts. Their proximity to one another and their distance from arm's reach suggest thematic connections and conceptual closeness to my thought process. In an influential paper of the hypertext era, Allison Kidd, a researcher at Hewlett-Packard, called such piles spatial holding patterns, suggesting that they play an important role in creating, exploring, and changing structures which can inform us in novel ways. Kathy's hypertext systems shifted all these mental patterns on screen and integrated them into larger writing and argument-building environments, presaging the ways in which we'd all soon find ourselves working on computers, with ever-expanding tabs, documents, and apps organized to suit our particular thought processes. They also demonstrate just how complex and nuanced hypertext can be when the technology is explored to its fullest potential. It supports not just links, but entire mental maps, systems that model, and more important, change our minds. This is the kind of thinking that prompts Kathy, 30-odd years later, to tell me that what's on paper is incidental, that the only important thing is what stays in your head. If my documents, strewn on my desk or clustered as icons on a screen, appear inscrutable to an outside observer, that's no flaw in my system. They should be meaningless, because they're only the remnants of a transformation process, like a sheaf of molted skin. The real technology is the user. That means me. And you. Hypertext 91. It all came to a head at Hypertext 91. The conference was held that year in San Antonio, Texas. North Carolina had, indeed, been the first and last time the hypertext community would be a manageable size. In the 4 years since Hypertext 87, it had exploded, and academics, writers, engineers, and developers from around the world converged in Texas for the occasion. Wendy Hall came from England to demonstrate the latest build of Microcosm. The conference floor, a hotel reception area lined with rows of tables, was clustered with representatives from dozens of hypertext projects, with names like Answerbook and Linkworks. Several tables down from Wendy Hall sat another British computer scientist, Tim Berners-Lee. He'd had his conference paper rejected but he'd come to San Antonio anyway, to show off a new system to the hypertext crowd. He'd brought Robert Caio, a colleague from CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research.